Welcome to the Sparkwood and 21 podcast. This podcast is brought to you by No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
We are covering the television series Twin Peaks.
Spoiler warning, we are not a spoiler-free podcast. If you haven't seen the show, we would love to have you listen to us, but don't listen till you catch up. You have been warned. I have a new PSA for all our listeners this week, and it is, don't steal the corn.
Thank you for downloading this podcast. We love having you all along for this twisted journey into Twin Peaks, and we love it even more so when we receive feedback and reviews on iTunes. Both of these actions are great ways to support our podcast. And speaking of, we will be having a feedback section at the end of this podcast. Okay, onwards and upwards. This is Season 2, Episode 2. This episode's titled Coma, written by Mark Frost and David Lynch, and it's also directed by David Lynch. Before we get going, what are your thoughts on this episode, Steve?
I loved it. It's still part of the classic era of Twin Peaks, like I've talked about before. I don't want to sound like a broken record and repeat that, but all longtime fans know that Season 2 kind of goes off the rails after a certain point, but we are well within the safety zone here. This is still a great episode.
All right, with that, we're going to go into recap. Cooper and Albert are having breakfast at the Great Northern. Cooper is talking about the Happy Generation, which is a king who was touched by the Dalai Lama, and then I guess his descendants or other kings that came after him is what I understood. And Cooper then tells Albert that Ronette has woken from her coma, but she is not able to speak yet, and that he's going to show Ronette a picture of Bob. And Cooper explains to Albert that Sarah Palmer had seen Bob in a vision, and he saw Bob in a dream. And this is where Albert asks if anyone has seen Bob on Earth yet. Albert makes a joke about Jacques' autopsy report, like he was talking about. It reminded me of Jaws, actually, the license plate.
Oh, yeah,
plate
I think that's what he was going for. Yeah, because he's just this big whale of a guy. But Albert's really good for this kind of thing. He's like he's a wall to bounce off Cooper's kind of out there-ness and bring it back down to reality, but also be a filter for the audience to kind of go, okay, this is where we're at with everything. Because Cooper has all these crazy things, and he's talking about the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhists and this and that. And then he talks about the man that he's seen in his dream and Sarah Palmer has seen in a vision. And now he's going to show a picture of this, you know, entity or this person to Ronette. And he's like, okay, so this is basically what you're doing. And he's really snarky and sarcastic about it, but I think it serves a really good purpose. And I think he's a good foil for Cooper's more, his out there moments, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Cause even when Cooper brings up like how he's missing his ring, and Albert's like, yeah, so, and that's when Cooper says, Albert, I'm glad to have you with us.
See, exactly. Yeah. It's just a pulling back down thing. It's the yin to the yang. If we're going to keep with Eastern philosophy, I guess, as the motif.
And that's what leads Albert to say, well, you know, that's not the only reason why I'm here, Wyndham Earl. And so this is the first time we have Wyndham Earl mentioned. And we know now with what Albert's saying that Wyndham Earl has committed a crime of some sort and has been placed in an asylum. It sounds like he calls it a laugh factory.
Yeah, yeah.
And but we actually at this, we know because we've watched this entire series of the crime. I believe the crime is because he killed his wife, who was also sleeping with Cooper.
That sounds familiar, yeah.
Yeah. And that's all I'm going to say about that, unless you had something else to say.
Yeah, I was just going to say that this is probably the first black mark that we see on Cooper's character.
We don't see it just yet.
We don't see it just yet, but I guess you could say this is the genesis, if you will, for that particular storyline. And because up until now, I mean, he's been the perfect Eagle Scout and a man of the law and the federal government and the whole nine yards. And here we see kind of a little blemish that besmirches the crystal clear.
The man is human.
Yeah, he's human.
And before we leave Albert and Cooper, the camera pans over and we see that Jonathan, who I often refer to as Mr. Grimface, is watching Cooper from behind a newspaper.
So when he's looking, he kind of pulls the newspaper down and he looks straight at Cooper and he seems a little bit surprised. I see a little bit of surprise registering on his face, which leads me to believe that he could possibly be, or we are maybe made to think that he could be, the shooter. Because he seems, the surprise could come from the fact that, like, why is this guy alive and drinking coffee, you know, in the morning in the Great Northern? Didn't I just put three caps in him the other night? So, I don't know. Obviously, it's a red herring because later on it's revealed to us that it was Josie Packard who did the shooting. And we've already commented on, you know, how that came to be and how it could have been other people and done that kind of speculation. But I think as a red herring, it's doing a good job because he's the only new addition that could have possibly done it, I think.
And he wears a lot of black.
That too, yeah.
So yeah, I could see that. We've got that red herring, and we've got another red. We've got many red herrings.
There's a lot of red herrings in the percolator
Yeah.
going on right
A
now.
lot of red herrings pissing upstream. Donna's delivering Meals on Wheels, and you could tell that she's in Creepsville because of the sound design in the scene. Donna's delivering to the Tremonts first, and Mrs. Tremont gets a little upset about creamed corn. So regarding the cream corn, we're going to actually discuss this in more detail when we get into the feedback section. Her grandson, who's sitting across the room, played by David Lynch's son, is a magician. Donna asks about Laura, and Miss Tremond recommends that Donna talk to Mr. Smith next door, that he and Laura were friends. Donna leaves and knocks on Mr. Smith's door. The grandson says cryptically to Mrs. Tremond, "She seemed like a very nice girl." Mr. Smith does not answer, so Donna slips a note under the door. As she leaves, Mr. Smith, I'm assuming, peeks out at her.
So, was it just me, or did Donna just not have very much reaction at all to the fact that this old lady, Miss Tremont, is looking at her plate of food from the Meals on Wheels people and going, "I told them specifically not to give me cream corn. Do you see cream corn on that plate?" And she looks down, and at first it's there, and then it's not. And this creepy little kid across in the corner is now holding it in his hand, and it disappeared off the plate. And she's saying, "My son's, or my grandson is training to be a magician."
You're right, because I've seen that David Blaine special where celebrities were crying, among other emotions, because his magical feats were so stunning. And I would say what this kid did was on par with the stuff that David Blaine did. So yeah, it would be appropriate for her to have a stronger reaction than she did. She almost looked like, "All right, that was cool, man." Like, kind of look on her face.
Maybe they're going for the whole like, "I'm the nonplussed teenager." You know what I mean? Nothing can impress me. I'm already jaded at the age of 17. I don't know, but when you compare, like you mentioned David Blaine, which is a good example because if you remember the specific special that we saw, he's in Harrison Ford's house and he
Right.
does that, and Harrison Ford is like almost in tears about this. He has a very visceral reaction to it, and then you compare that to Donna's reaction, and it's night and day. If the kid got up and pulled a quarter out from behind my ear, that's great. But from 3 yards away, all the cream corn that was on a plate just appears in his hands. I would be freaking out. I'm not criticizing Donna for this. I'm trying to bring up a point to say, like, maybe there's something about living in Twin Peaks that makes you, I don't want to say susceptible because that seems like too easy of a word, but it makes you more amenable to the idea of magic and things that would be really out of place in other contexts, okay to you. I might be reaching here. Let me know if I am. But I
I don't
feel
know.
like
I don't think so.
I feel like the like a normal person. I mean, put yourself in her shoes. You're delivering this food. This lady complains about cream corn on the plate. Next thing you know, across the room, it's in this little kid who's dressed in a tuxedo, basically. It's in his hands.
I think the characters are still capable of being shocked when they see things that are, supernatural, even though they've grown up with the darkness in the woods and whatnot. I think it's interesting that the young magician said that she seemed like a very nice girl in the past tense. What do you make of that?
I don't know. If I didn't know what I already know about, Donna being around for the rest of the series and everything, I would feel like that's pretty foreboding. Like he knows something about her fate. Like she's about to get hit by a truck, as she leaves with the Meals on Wheels. But other than that, I can't really speak to it. I don't know. It is kind of cryptic for somebody's, because usually you would use a different participle and you would say, "She seems like a nice girl," because she's still living. You can see her outside, going over to Mr. Smith's house. So.
So she seemed like a nice girl because she went over to Harold Smith after they prompted her. Like, they're disappointed she took that bait.
Is it? I guess that would be implying that there's something inherently wrong with going to see Harold Smith, walking down that particular path and doing that particular action. I mean, we would have to assume that they have some sort of psychic foresight and they know in a roundabout way what's going to happen or what could potentially happen. So they're kind of lamenting the fact that, well, she was a nice girl, but now that she's made this particular turn or bend in her life, she's in for a world of hurt.
She's clearly meddlesome.
Yeah, she's clearly metal. Maybe she should have said, "No, I'm not going to go talk to that guy. Thank you very much. Eat your cream corn, old lady."
Getting out of Creepsville right now. So Cooper and Truman visit Ronette, another scene that would be ordinary if it were not for the stools. Once seated, Cooper begins talking to Ronette. He tells her he does not want to upset her, but he needs to show her some sketches. He shows her a picture of Leo first. This does not register, so next Coop shows her Bob. This leads to a fit. Ronette is almost saying train over and over again while she's thrashing about.
She gets really sketched out. All right, that was bad. Sorry, folks. I had to throw it in there, though.
I remember what a joy it was watching this interaction with the stools the first time I saw this episode. It's funny because it's depicting a activity that occurs in real life, and but in real life it's actually dull in that sort of context. But in our entertainment, which is often a distilled version of life, it's a pleasant thing to watch. I think mostly because it's rare within that context.
Well, when you have a show that's so fantastic and has all of these different things, you've got this unlikely humor, you've got this crazy town that's almost like sequestered away from the rest of the country and the way the rest of the country thinks, and you've got this magic at work and this darkness at work and all of these bright and vibrant personalities working. Whenever you interject the mundane into that, it stands out like bigger than anything could. It would be like a zombie explosion inside of a romantic comedy. It's the same effect, only completely different, in the context, I guess. But yeah, so I see what you're saying. It's nice to watch it because it gives it adds like a realism to it.
Yeah.
Because these are just two people having a conversation, and Cooper makes sure to stop. And even though he feels like she's probably coming in and out of consciousness at this point, or isn't really all there at any given point, he's saying, "Excuse us, Ronette. Excuse us, Ronette." He makes a point to say, like, "I'm sorry this is happening. Sorry that we have to stop what we were doing with you. Ruin, in like."
I just thought of something because, our listener, Daniel, he talks about another scene later on, which we're going to talk about in feedback. But I think this is the same kind of setup that he talks about, where you have something humorous happen right before something scary happens, because her reaction to the picture of Bob is a bit disturbing.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, that's a good point. It is, she does have that, you're lulled into this false sense of, okay,
security.
this is just going to be a very vanilla scene, and she's probably not going to react too well when she sees a picture of Bob. We knew that was coming, but you don't like the contrast between the two, the two people having this very amicable conversation about how to lift up and put down a stool, and then this girl freaking out about seeing Bob. By the way, whoever plays Ronette Pulaski, I'm not sure. I don't know if I've ever known the actress's name.
Phoebe Augustine.
Phoebe Augustine. Kudos to her because she does the coming out of the coma freak out, the swimming in the pool pedal kind of thing, where she's flailing her arms like nobody else I've ever seen. So the whole thing about the stools, backing up just a bit, that was not in the script, right? They just came in there and they were supposed to sit on the stools in the script and start talking, but the stools weren't at the right place for them to sit down comfortably. So they had to mess with them and they just left that whole thing
Is
in
that
there, right?
something that I said years ago that I don't remember where
Yeah.
that came from?
Yeah, I
I
think
can't
so.
verify that now. I mean, it's I God, that was a
It
long time
seemed to
ago.
come from like an official source. I don't think it was one of those internet rumor type things, but we'll just leave it. We'll let it
Yeah.
lie because I
'Cause
if we can't source it correctly, we don't want to put it out there.
Yeah.
But now we have confirmation that Ronette Pulaski saw Bob. Coop already knows this, but he has to go through all the official channels to make it legal.
It's confirming it for
Yeah.
him, his suspicion. So Ben and Jerry decide which ledger to burn. Well, they actually don't decide.
They are 100% sure that they're not sure about anything.
They're 100% certain that they're not sure. Ben offers marshmallows in the meantime.
Jerry's awfully he's awfully enthused about these marshmallows. He's just like, "Marshmallows?" Like he hasn't seen him for 20 years or something like that. He's like, "Ben, where are those hickory sticks?"
It's just such a great idea at that moment, I guess.
Yeah. It's just, it's food, you know, the two of them share that bond of food. 'Cause I mean, he's sitting there eating that. What kind of, just as an aside, what kind of cheese do you think that that pig, that smoked cheese pig was made out of? I'm going with Gouda.
Yeah, it could be a number of different cheeses. There's a lot of smoked cheeses out
It
there.
looked like Gouda to me though, but you're right, there is.
Last episode, Ben was asking if anyone has seen Audrey. So we know later on in this episode, he reports her missing to Harry Truman. But notice how his polka dot socks match his tie. His daughter is potentially in trouble, and he still has the presence of mind and whimsy to coordinate his clothing in such a way.
He's a piece of crap. That's all that really boils down to. You know, the only member of his family that he really cares about is his brother, and that's only because they're partners in crime. You know, and they probably know so many secrets about each other that, you know, if one of them dies, the other one's going to have some sort of secret lockbox stashed away somewhere that's going to come to light because of an attorney and be like, okay, now I'm going to have all this information on you that's going to incriminate you. So they just keep each other alive because they're afraid. I don't know. That's just some paranoid scenario I just made up on the spot. But they seem to
Interesting.
be, huh?
It's interesting.
They seem to be the only people that they actually care about in a familial sense. You never see him interact with his son. You never see him interact with his wife. And well, up until this point, I know later on he goes through his crazy Ben phase and Civil War crap and all that stuff. But yeah, it's really disheartening to see a dad care that little about what's going on with his daughter. I mean, have two cats. It's like if one of them was missing, I don't know if I would have the mental wherewithal to coordinate my wardrobe that morning.
So at the double R, Andy tussles with tape as he hangs up a sketch of Bob in the restaurant's window. Major Briggs is present. The log lady enters and sits down next to Major Briggs. Norma talks to the log lady about her pitch gum leavings.
I think I mentioned this last episode, and this is where it's at. It's a good scene because Norma's just laying down the law, like, "Look, bitch, make sure you're not spitting that stuff out on my counters."
Well, she starts out really well. She's like, "It's always a pleasure to see you."
Yeah, but she's trying to
But
be, you know, diplomatic and cordial. Like, I want to keep you as a customer, but you need to stop doing that.
So the log lady asks Major Briggs about his medals and asks if he is proud. He says achievement is its own reward, pride obscures it. I like that. I like everything he says.
Pretty much, yeah.
The log lady says the log has something to say to Major Briggs, and she tells him, deliver the message, and he understands what the log is saying to him.
Yeah, I really like this little conversation between the two of them, this exchange, because he takes her 100% seriously and at face value. And I don't know if he's had a run-in with her before or if this is the first time they've met because they don't seem familiar. He doesn't say, "Hello, Margaret," or anything like that, or "How is your log doing?" or anything like that. He just kind of listens to what she has to say, looks at the log, and hears it. And you can look on her face and tell, like, wow, this guy's taking me and my log seriously. This is awesome. It's probably the high point of her month, really.
I think it's his first encounter with her because she says she does not introduce the log.
That's right, you're right. I didn't think about that.
So at the sheriff's department, there is a fly buzzing around Lucy. Andy tells Lucy that he's sterile, which does not mean he does not need to take baths. So he wants to know how she is pregnant. It ends with her hilariously taking tape off his forehead
So now
and shunning him.
you I could kind of side with Lucy before because he's not being communicative. And in a relationship, you have to communicate. It's the A1 thing you have to do. And he wasn't doing that, but now he is. And now she's the one who's not giving up the ghost, you know? So it's like,
She's startled, she's embarrassed, and she's got to figure some stuff out.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure she feels caught out or whatever on this, but like I could go back and forth on whose side I'm on, but I'm definitely Team Andy at this point. You know, I mean, just thinking from a guy's point of view, if I had, you know, either gotten snipped or if I was sterile to begin with and didn't need to, and, you know, my girlfriend's like, "I'm pregnant." Like, yeah, there might be a problem.
He deserves an explanation. So at the sheriff's department, oh, I already said that. In Truman's office, Hanks waits for the sheriff. He did not have permission to be in his office.
I feel like this scene was just there to let you know that, to kind of give a little bit more of a deeper backstory on Hank and to let you know that he used to be a bookhouse boy and he was actually one of the better ones, or he said he was the best of us. So it's like a fallen angel type thing going on.
So he was corrupted in some way, and maybe, if the series had carried on, maybe we would have got the background on that. Maybe we would have found out about the domino.
Yeah, possibly even a redemption arc.
Yeah.
Who knows?
So Lucy pages in and transfers a call from Ben Horn. Audrey has been missing for as much as 2 days, and Ben is enjoying a glass of wine as he tells Harry about all of this.
He is completely nonchalant about this. I mean, that's the kind of laid-back attitude you would have if you needed to call your insurance company and be like, "Hey, I just wanted to let you know I still haven't got my check yet. Just whenever you guys get around to that."
But it brings to mind, because the way he's talking to Harry, what Albert Rosenfield had said in that episode where they buried Laura when they were fighting over her body.
Right.
And he said to Ben, regarding Ben's position in the community, and this is a paraphrase, he says, regarding, your position in the community, it guarantees you, some venality and sincerity and rather irritating method of expressing yourself, which I think that describes the way he's talking to Harry right now, and sincerity being key.
Also, a choice of drink is in question here. Because if you're going to be worried about your daughter missing, being missing for however many days, and you're going to drink, it's going to be one of those things where somebody pulls a bottle of hooch out from under a table and says, "Here, looks like you need a drink," and then you pour it and you drink it. It's some sort of stiff whiskey or something like
Right.
that, and
Gets the job done quick.
right, and it just puts you in the right frame of mind. But he's sipping wine like he's some sort of dandy,
Yeah.
It's just. You're not concerned about anything. You're making this call because you pretty much have to. His wife probably put him up to it.
And this lack of concern is how the show tries to draw the viewer's eye towards him regarding who could possibly be the killer and he being one of the prime suspects.
That's a good point. I didn't really ever think about that until you brought it up, but they're showing you character traits that could make him cold and callous enough to be that killer. And we're still at the point in the series where they're kind of throwing out the occasional red herring toward you.
So now we're with Ben in his office at the Great Northern. Jerry tells Ben that Catherine did not sign the life insurance papers. Ben is not too concerned about that or the fact that his daughter is missing, which we've already stated. Ben is making a call to Einar in Iceland. Leland arrives and Ben learns as he talks to Einar that Leland called and told Einar about the fire. Ben tries to assuage Einar. Meanwhile, Leland sees a sketch of Bob. Leland says he knows this man. He knew him from when he was a little boy at his grandfather's summer house. Leland leaves. Ben asks Jerry to kill Leland, and then Jerry asks if this is real or is it one strange, twisted dream.
You're right. Ben does really have a laid-back attitude about everything up until the point where he figures out that Einar has been told about the fire because he's just like, win some, lose some. And then Leland comes in and he's like, "I've got a great idea. You guys need to get on the phone with the," and then he figures out that, "Oh, look, by coincidence, you guys are on the phone with the same guy I was telling you to get on the phone with." And then they learn about the fire. So the insurance papers not being signed by Catherine, no big deal. His daughter missing for at least 2 days, maybe more, no big deal. But the Norwegians learning about the fire, big no-no. So hey, at least he can be impassioned about something.
So now we're at the hospital, and Doc Hayward is updating Shelley on Leo's current condition. Leo's in a coma.
Coma two. So now we have two people in a coma. They should have called the episode coma.
They did.
Right. So.
So Shelley's, feeling bad for Leo, despite all he's put her through.
It shows a lot of compassion on her part because, I mean, she's in love with somebody else, Bobby. And this guy was abusive to the point of actually killing her because, I mean, he tied her up and left her for dead in a place that he was setting on fire. He fully intended to kill her and then kill her boyfriend. So, me putting myself in her position, I'd feel hard to gum up any kind of sympathy for the guy, but she does.
Yeah,
So,
she
it says a
does.
lot about her character.
And he's a hairy beast.
Yeah, guy's got like some Wolverine chest going on.
So back at the sheriff's department, Lucy gets a phone call. The caller will not tell her who they are, so she hangs up. And we've got feedback on that as well. So you have any thoughts on
No, I'll
that?
wait till we get to the feedback on
Okay.
it.
So at One Eye Jack's, Audrey offers to help entertain Battis. He has mommy issues, I think.
Something's going on with that, with the vacuum cleaner and the whole nine yards. What?
Audrey tells the vacuuming girl to get lost. You can't hear anything they're saying, but the body language tells you everything. Audrey unplugs the vacuum and repurposes the cord like a pro. She presses Battis for information, about who's the owner. She wants confirmation, I think. Which I think is
Right.
smart. And then she also asks about Laura.
And she gets her answers because, I mean, that guy is in a compromised position
For now.
for now.
So Shelley and Bobby sit in his car, his dad's car, to be precise. Bobby tells her that he made a call regarding Leo's disability in order to get the disability, Leo has to live at home with Shelley. Shelley does not want him home at all, but Bobby talks her into it, and she is talked into it because all she wants is to be with Bobby.
Yeah. This now we watched Fire Walk With Me last night,
I was thinking the same
and this
thing.
is a pretty cool callback to a scene. Well, I guess
It
the
was in
Fire
Missing,
Walk With Me. Yeah, it was in the missing and deleted scenes of Fire Walk With Me. So
which is called Missing Pieces.
missing pieces. And I don't know if these missing pieces were included in any other versions of Fire Walk With Me. I know they weren't in the original VHS, obviously, but the first time it came out on DVD, I don't remember or not, 'cause we have a copy of that as well, but this is from the Blu-ray box set that came out within the last 6 months. But there's the missing pieces and deleted scenes from it, and there's a scene where Norma and Big Ed are in his truck and they're playing a radio station, and there's yet I don't know if it's I don't think it's the same song, but there's another song from the Twin Peaks soundtrack that's on there when they flip through the radio stations, and it kind of has that same radio dial that's going across. So
I think the first song that they had on was the song that Norma and Ed were listening to,
okay.
I think. But they changed it to one that teenagers would like more.
Yeah, and you know, Twin Peaks teenagers though. You know, because I was a teenager at the time that they were teenagers, like actually. And that's not really like teenage music. That sounds more like adult music. It's kind of like blues with a little bit of oomph to it.
Yeah.
You know, but when I was a teenager, I wasn't listening to that. I mean, most teenagers don't listen to blues. They listen to, but it's Twin Peaks teenager music. You know, they're like, yeah, they're really into it.
We haven't talked much about the music on this podcast.
Well, it seems like from so far as I can tell, it's very specific to the town. You know what I mean? And I think it's one of the things that sets them apart. You know, I always talk about like Twin Peaks is different than the rest of the world, and it really is. And that's just one of the small manifestations is the music. But like I can't imagine too many teenagers listening to, you know, Audrey's Dance and being like, this is so dreamy. And then, you know, and there's actually some very, very horrible music in this episode later on.
Oh yeah. Okay,
That we'll get to talk about.
let's see. Okay. So Cooper talks to Diane in his room at the Great Northern. He tells her about Wyndham Earle and about Audrey's absence. Major Briggs knocks on his door and asks to come in. Major Briggs tells Cooper that he has a message for him. He cannot discuss the nature of his work, but he does reveal about his monitoring of other galaxies and the discovery of radio messages.
The transmissions were coded because he had like a big sheet of readout, and you know, whatever they got back from whatever they had sent out, I guess, or if they're just reading the waves that are out there, however it works, the computer made it into symbols,
I
which
think
were
it's language from an Imperial probe droid.
So there's just a huge Imperial probe droid out there just sending this out. Cooper, Cooper, Cooper.
Owls are not what they seem.
But it gets coded into stuff that we can understand, but still is gibberish. It looked like there was four or five numbers or letters, and then there'd be a slash, and then, you know, and even Briggs says it's gibberish until they get to the point where whenever Cooper was shot, it says the owls are not what they seem, and then later on, when he turns it over, you know, hours down the road, it says Cooper, 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 Cooper. Now, what do you make of the fact that once Cooper hears the owls are not what they seem, the first thing he does is he asks. He doesn't seem surprised that that information exists outside of his own mind and his own visions. He's just interested in who told you that. You know, I mean, I don't know how I would react. I would probably get around to that question eventually, but he jumps right to it. You know, he wants to know, well, why did you bring this to me? You know, what do you make of that?
Well, it's a good question
Yeah,
because
yeah. But I mean, what answer do you think he's coming for, or he's trying to get at? Do you think that, I don't know, I'll just let you
well, he
answer that.
probably wants to because he's been told those that same thing by the giant. And then now you've got this Major Briggs guy who he there's no reason for Major Briggs to talk to an FBI agent as far as he knows, especially about the nature of his job. And so of course he's going to be like, well, this is the same thing that I heard the giant say. There's got to be some reason why you're bringing this to me. And I mean, I would want to know.
So do you think that
Like,
there's
who talked to you? Did the giant visit you?
Who said this? Who said this? So do you think that to me, I think there's an interesting juxtaposition of clues in this scene, because eventually at the end of the scene, we're getting to the point where we're getting clues beamed down from outer freaking space. But at the beginning of the scene, there's a clue to a much more immediate mystery right directly underfoot, and it's still not being noticed, that being Audrey's letter. So it's like the most basic things that, any detective or sleuth would try to figure out first are being completely ignored and missed. I guess I should say that's a better term for it. But things from outer space are now coming into play. I don't know if there's any significance to that or what, but.
Do you think this has any relation to what we saw in the missing pieces about them coming out of pure air?
Well, we kind of decided that that would be electricity, right? Because there's
Well,
no air in space.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, we decided that, but we're not in a, we could
Yeah.
still like decide to on something else, you
Yeah, it's
know,
true.
when
We're
you
not the
propped up against other information.
bosses of this.
We're not.
It's
We're quite confused.
something to consider though. I did like the interplay between Cooper and Briggs when they're both talking about being professional men and being in the employ of the federal government and honoring oaths and, things like that, and not being able to talk about certain things.
Yeah, I think that was, good to kind of have that information pass between the two of them, that you have a mutual respect, and
Right.
I think make Major Briggs comfortable about, even though he knew he needed to deliver the message, but this is the right person to tell it to, or he's doing the right thing.
Yeah, he got confirmation from the log on that, so.
So next up, there's the trifecta sing-along, as you were alluding to earlier. As cheesy as it is, though, I totally respect how they decide to spend their time together. It's productive. I mean, for them to make a song. I mean, it could be a better song,
Yeah,
but it's cool that they're doing
I
it.
get what you're saying. I get what you're saying. That as far as three teenagers spending a rainy afternoon and sometime in February in Twin Peaks, or maybe we're early March at this point, I don't know. It's cold and dreary outside. It's the Pacific Northwest. They're inside making music. That's great. Now, could they have made better music? Yeah, I think they could have. But apparently, he can actually play guitar like that.
Yeah,
So.
he can play guitar, and they brought him into the studio to sing the song, and he had a really hard time hitting those notes, and they really pushed him to do it.
Oh man, that does not sound enviable to be in the studio with like David Lynch and Angelo Badalamenti and having them be like, okay, we're just gonna do this until you get it. You could just see the sun going down out there and you're like, crap.
Can you just get Julie Cruise to do this?
I actually thought that that's what they were going for with this song. Like this is a male version of Julie Cruise, the way that he's crooning over the strumming of the guitar and everything. It has that feel to it. I wish they just would have got Julie Cruise, actually.
Oh, I mean, it's fine. It is cheesy. It's embarrassing to watch in a way. I'm embarrassed for all of them. I think Donna more than anybody, though.
Why are you more embarrassed for Donna? Is it because she's staring at James the whole time when he's saying, singing the lyrics of the song, like, I'm just paraphrasing here, but I only want to be in love with you or whatever.
Well, she's making eyes with a guy that she's into, and he's clearly into somebody else right there,
Right,
which is
right.
annoying. When she gets up and walks out, he has to walk up to her and ask her what's wrong and act oblivious, because it's, you don't hold a gaze for that long with someone
Right,
and
right.
not realize that you're doing it. So during this, what you're talking about, the phone rings and it's Harold Smith. I guess she, because she says, yes, and I got yours too. I'm thinking that maybe he's the one who sent the note for look into Meals on Wheels.
That would make sense. Yeah, it would be. He would know who she was because
Laura's
of Laura's
diary.
diary. So he would already. He probably already feels like he knows her. And I don't remember exactly, but I think he says something to that
He
extent when they
does.
start talking. So that would. You're right. You're absolutely right. I didn't think of that myself, but that makes perfect sense. He's the one who sends that note.
So they make plans. They don't say goodbye.
Yeah, he just kind of hangs
Hangs up
up.
on her. Kind of seems like a big jerk.
I guess you lose your sense of social niceties when you live by yourself
Yeah.
all the time.
People on television, they don't hardly ever say bye, though. I've noticed there's a lot of like hanging up without
Yeah.
saying bye. I wonder if there's some sort of rule of cool that they apply to
They also answer phones very quickly. If you notice that you see people like when they pick up a phone to dial somebody else, they're talking almost immediately.
Yeah.
You know, I know it's for expedience's sake, but it's just like the real world doesn't work like that.
So during this whole time, Maddie is left alone and she sees Bob. Bob slowly comes into the scene and climbs over a couch and walks directly toward her and up to the point where he's practically mashed up to the camera. She freaks out, understandably, because it's creepy. Creepy's an understatement. It's not even the right word.
Donna and James run over to comfort her.
Right.
And, you know, like I said earlier in the cast, we watched Fire Walk With Me last night, and we probably hadn't seen it for about 10 or 12 years, at least, I would
At
say.
least.
And you see a lot of Bob in that movie. But Bob was just as creepy in this scene as he was in anything that he did in the movie. Because it's, you know, before when you've seen him, he kind of materializes out of the corner and he might jump at you or just kind of peer at you from like, you know, the frame of a bed or something like that. But you get this full shot of him walking in like he owns the place, stepping over all the furniture. He's on this like inexorable path to get in your face, and it's unnerving. And I think if I was Maddie, I would have screamed too.
So now Cooper's dreaming, and he's dreaming about the giant, Ronette, Bob, and about the phrase, "The owls are not what they seem." You can hear the fan outside of Laura's bedroom rhythmically in the background, and you even see Sarah Palmer running down the stairs. The phone rings, and it's Audrey. She is crying, and she's not forthcoming, annoyingly, about where she is. Blackie catches her and hangs the phone up, and she tells Audrey that she's in a world of trouble.
These two are so stupid. Audrey's being dumb, but these two are stupid. They've got their boss's daughter. You know, this guy could have them killed, and they're messing around with their boss's daughter. It's just bad business.
Well, Blackie, I think, has been waiting for the right, like the whole revenge is best served cold. She's been waiting for the right moment to get to Ben because Ben hooked her on heroin so he could control her. So that's what's going to lead her to do what she does to Audrey. Okay, so you want to go ahead and get into feedback? We got a letter from Daniel, who's written to us the last couple of podcasts, and I'm going to paraphrase a lot that he says here. And in his first query, he's wanting to know about the representation of pain and suffering, which is also known as garmenbosia, the creamed cord. He w wants to know basically what our thoughts on it. He does bring up certain points that in the movie, how we see Mike vehemently hunt down Bob and confront him when he's within Leland at a traffic stop. And rants about how Bob stole the corn that he had canned above the store, and it somehow connected to Leland's flashback of murdering Teresa Banks and so on. So, his specific question is, why do you think Donna, who has shown no connection to the supernatural world of the show, stumbles in on these two at all, the Tremonts, and why can she see them? Is she one of the gifted as well? And so we should comment on the corn as well as answer those questions.
I don't think that she's gifted. I don't think she's one of the gifted. If you mean like the people who say like Sarah Palmer or Maddie who can see Bob, I don't think she's one of them. But she's part of all this. She was best friends with Laura, and she's friends now with Maddie, and you know she's investigating things, and she's part of it. And I think the Tremonts have chosen to manifest themselves to her, at least in this fashion, because they're trying to point her in a certain direction, or at least give her options. Because we speculated earlier that possibly her going over to actually see Harold was lamentable in some way, shape, or form. But they are there to give her that option, so to speak. And they have to have physical manifestations in the first place, or they wouldn't be on the Meals on Wheels list in the first place if nobody actually lived there. So maybe there's actually some other physical person that's there that we didn't see, and which is kind of creepy. But
Which I believe is the case, actually.
okay, that's like I've said, full disclosure, I've seen all the season one episodes numerous times, but the season two episodes, I think I've seen all of them up until Leland is revealed as the killer once or twice, and then the ones after that only once.
It's okay. We've let everybody know that we're
Yeah.
rewatching this, and it's been a long time. But I remember there was another woman there later because Donna ends up leading I think Cooper to that area. I can't remember the details, but there was some other lady living
So
there.
somebody actually does live there,
Yeah.
and these spirits from the lodge or the apartment or whatever you want to call it choose to manifest themselves at certain times.
See, I'm thinking, yeah, I don't know if she's I don't think she's gifted. I think she's skirting danger because she's being meddlesome, maybe in their eyes, so she's playing with fire a
Yeah.
little bit there. Fire walk with me. It's a she's coming a little too close, so maybe that's why, they're starting to kind of show up in her life.
Speaking of which, I thought this episode, Donna's behavior in this episode was very striking as compared to last episode. Last episode, she was chain smoking like you wouldn't believe. This episode, she doesn't touch a cigarette the whole
Yeah,
time.
it's like she's two different people. As far as the garmenbosia, the corn, I can't really speculate too far on that because, like Steve said, we watched Fire Walk with Me last night, and we watched the Missing Pieces documentary, or the not the documentary, but the deleted scenes after, and I'm more confused now than I was before. But all I can say is that I know it represents pain and suffering. It seems like obviously there's an issue between Bob and Mike regarding it. Bob seems to be following his own rules and maybe addicted to it. I don't know. As far as why Mrs. Tremond wouldn't, why she would be offended at the sight of it, and I'm not really quite sure.
Well, I think Daniel's putting out there that she had maybe already had her fill and she doesn't want to be seen by the others in the group, especially the one that's with her in the guise of her grandson, quote unquote, as taking more than her share. But I've always thought of the garmenbosia, I've kind of like flipped it on its head in my own head and looked at it as if this is pain and sorrow, maybe these people in the lodge or whatever are required to eat a certain amount, but after that, it's discretionary. And if you don't want it, you can just push away your plate and say you've had enough. And she doesn't want it. She doesn't want any more of it. But the little kid, he's just like, he says sometimes things happen just like that. And he snaps his fingers. Then the next thing you know, he's got a handful of the cream corn. So maybe because of his age, he can consume more without any, proportionate ill effects, perhaps.
See, I can't remember if we're enlightened more on this later in the season, so we're definitely our attention's going to be focused on it now. It's
Yeah.
like we're primed for it, so hopefully
Garmenbosia is a mystery. It's an enigma.
and you can have hope that there'll be more explanation in 2016, but David Lynch likes to leave things up for interpretation, so we might not get one.
Yeah, if we don't, but it's awfully fun to speculate on.
Yeah, it is. So, his next query is about who would have called the sheriff's office and not want to leave their name, where Lucy said, I'm sorry, if you're not going to give me your name, I can't pass you on to the sheriff. And he proposed that it could be possibly Jonathan want to talk to him, maybe something about Josie, and but he thinks that would be the most boring. His other choice was Philip Gerard, the one-armed man, just because we saw him skulking around before trying to get in to see the sheriff and sell him some shoes without an appointment. And then his third choice was Leland Palmer, calling to tell the sheriff about recognizing Bob in the wanted poster from his childhood summer home. If it was Leland, is he trying to just share his info on Bob as an anonymous tip first? Or is this a clue that Leland's identity is in question? So he further says, if that's the case, Leland's identity could be in flux at this point, and this could be the first sign that maybe he's controlled by Bob, and that Bob might be actually doing this to throw the police off the scent of the actual killer being Leland, having Leland call and
Well, out of all the things that he runs down in this particular question, the most interesting by far is this one. The one that Leland could be doing it, being controlled by Bob and doing it to try to like throw a monkey wrench in the
the
works.
investigation.
But earlier in the episode, when we have the scene where he says, "This is the guy. I know him from, when I was a kid at my grandfather's summer home." That is his grandfather's summer home, right? That to me would actually be more of an obfuscation of the whole thing because you're making him seem like a physical entity. You're making him seem like a person who could be found. So if Leland's calling up Sheriff Truman I don't think this is likely for a couple of reasons. The first reason, first and foremost reason, being that if Lucy doesn't recognize his voice, then, which I believe she would, then Truman is going to recognize his voice right away. So it would be foolhardy of him to try to do that unless Bob could somehow be in control and mask his voice. But even then, your effect on how much you could throw off the game of the cops in this situation is a little bit limited, you know. But unfortunately, I think that, well, just to say, that's how I feel about the whole Leland thing. I think it's the most interesting thing that's put out there, but I don't think it's likely. But I have to agree with him on the part that it's probably Jonathan, because that's the most likely person, because he was probably trying to call and find out information about Josie, because he's looking for Josie as well, because nobody except Pete, and now through extension of him, Truman knows that she went to Seattle on a quote shopping spree. But my little pet theory that I like to throw out there is that it's Wyndham Earle, because he first gets mentioned in this episode, and he's kind of an enigma that's forming in the mythos of Twin Peaks in this episode. It's the first time you hear his name in the whole nine yards, but I understand that it doesn't hold weight. I understand that my own theory is just a little bit.
It could be his first sign of presence.
It could be, because I think he has been observing.
Active presence.
Yeah, active presence. I think he's been observing what's going on in Twin Peaks from afar for a little bit, you know, at least as soon as he was able to locate where Cooper was. But at the end of the day, that's my fun theory. And, you know, I had to poke a hole in the Leland theory with, you know, what I said. You know, maybe that's just me doing it, doesn't, and nothing's definitive. But I have to agree that even though Jonathan is the most boring option, it's probably the most likely option.
And because I don't remember if this was revealed to be true or revealed to us who made the call, but I have one theory that I don't totally believe, but it could be Catherine too, just because she's missing and
Yeah.
we know she's still alive, but I can't remember who actually made the phone call if we're
Yeah.
ever told.
And Catherine kind of fits into that Leland thing too. This town is so close knit
That's true.
that Sheriff Truman, especially being the sheriff, is not going to not recognize a lot of these voices.
And then Daniel goes on to talk about how the sheriff nor Albert's team made a very thorough sweep of Cooper's room after the shooting because they missed Audrey's note, which is under the bed. Good point.
We've been over this one upside down and sideways, and
We decide it's Andy.
it's Andy. It was Andy's just, he's just doing a bad job.
You said he whacked his head and maybe somehow knocked the note under the bed and.
Yeah, he went to go grab for the note, and he hit his head on the phone receiver, and then he fell down, and he blacked out for a minute, and then he got back up, and he forgot what he was doing, so he just went to go use the restroom. But, you know, you
He's
win,
thinking about Lucy
you know,
being pregnant.
to paraphrase Ben in this episode, you win some, you lose some. Sometimes you whack your head and you find a pair of boots that has bad stuff hidden in them, you know, and gives you a clue as to what Leo Johnson was doing. Sometimes you whack your head and you forget a note, you
Yep.
know. But
Yep.
it's, in all seriousness, it is shoddy police work. No in-universe explanation can explain that away.
And then Daniel says, it's somewhat frustrating that Major Briggs references the giant's second clue. The owls are not what they seem, but no further explanation is given for what this could mean. Is this a bad time to ask what your particular theories, respectively, are about this mystery?
There's never a bad time to ask that. I don't know what you've got for it, but I would think that it is a little bit frustrating, but I think it deepens the mystery and it leaves it up to interpretation. And when they're going through and looking at the different images, I think it's in Cooper's mind. He sees Bob where he's at on the by the bars of the bed in Laura's room, and then the owl is transposed on his face. So I think it may be letting us, the viewer, know that, yeah, we haven't laid out all our cards yet as to what the owl actually is or what it means or why it's not what it seems, but it's not a good thing. And it could be a vessel for the evil spirits, you know, the doppelganger spirits that live in the lodge.
Yeah, I mean, we do see when Leland dies, Bob leaves Leland's body and inhabits an owl. And it could be just the evil people, like you said, or the evil entities from that particular thing. I'm not sure. I mean, I think it references maybe all of these characters, though, that come from this other place. Maybe not all the just the evil ones, because you have the the room service waiter, and
Right.
he's in there's an inhabitant living inside him, the giant, and Philip Gerard has Mike inside him, and Leland has Bob, and so I think it's trying to get Cooper to see that it's not
Things,
it's more complex, so
right.
there's more to
Don't take
this,
it at face value.
right? But once again, this is something that's not really totally explored or made clear to us, and it could be up for debate which particular inhabitants it's referring. It could be just Bob,
Yeah.
because I think he's the only one we see that actually goes inside of an owl.
Right. But, to answer Daniel's question directly, I don't find it frustrating. I find it more of a deepening of the mystery around it. And it leaves more up to our own interpretation. That way we can have these kinds of conversations about it. Perhaps all the evil spirits in the lodge inhabit owls, and all the good spirits inhabit snowshoe rabbits.
Maybe. Or
It's,
ducks.
or ducks, yeah.
Look at that. Ducks
But
and a lake.
there was a point. Cooper had the run-in with Waldo a few episodes earlier, and he says, "I don't like birds," and he says it very flatly. So maybe we're establishing a sort of, good versus evil thing here, to where Cooper's the good guy and the owls are the bad guy, and there's a reason why he didn't like the birds. Maybe he knows he has a psychological or perhaps preternatural aversion to birds for this reason.
So Daniel goes on to say, I just want to mention that the Just You and I demo being cut on Hayward's living room floor is one of the most excruciating but yet comically hilarious moments in the show for me, because it really drove home the fact that nothing like this would ever happen on literally any other TV show I've seen. And it also serves as such a great setup, almost lulling you to relax and be amused before freaking the hell out of you by what happens next as poor Maddie sees the bo that Bob simply. Before poor Maddie sees Bob simply stroll into the house, climb over the couch, and assault her mind at one of the most disturbing visuals yet in the series. Yeah, I think this has happened time before, many times before, and I wasn't even aware of it until Daniel pointed it out here, and so that made that stool scene,
Yeah.
pop out to me this
Yeah.
time as we were discussing it. So I think it's a texture that you apply to this medium, for lack of a better term. And it lulls you into a sense of security, and then which just makes it more impactful when you see something super scary.
Bob was really unnerving in this scene, because in previous scenes where we've seen him, he kind of materializes in whoever's watching him, the gifted people, I guess you could say, like Daniel referred to them, for lack of a better term, at
Maddie's
least.
definitely a gifted.
Yeah, she's definitely gifted. And but when he's appeared to the gifted people previous to this, he kind of materializes out of a certain corner of the room and then jumps towards them, or looks at them menacingly, or does something of that nature, and it's kind of limited. This is creepy because it's like, phantasm style. He's just walking into the room, and then he just nonchalant, like he just doesn't have a care in the world. Then he turns and looks at her all in one fluid motion and starts walking over furniture towards her, like he's this inexorable apex predator that is
Yeah,
going to get her.
unrelenting.
Yeah, unrelenting. And that's scary in and of itself. But honestly, I don't think he was after Maddie. Because you see, Bobby and Donna had got up to go do their little thing in the corner, and Bob had already been called there mystically, magically by this absurdly horrible music, and he was coming to exact his revenge, and Maddie was the only person he saw, so she was just going to get the brunt of it.
Poor Maddie.
Yep. That's some shitty friends right there. To play a song like that and then to leave you alone to let Bob, have his way with you.
Like calling Bloody Mary in the bathroom,
Yep, and then
and they
locking your
left
friend
her.
in the door,
Oh,
like,
lame.
we're gonna lock you in here.
So one final thing from Daniel. He says, in Cooper's dream at the end, we distinctly hear an ominous whooshing sound in the background, along with such familiar images as Sarah Palmer descending the staircase and Bob crouching at the foot of Laura's bed. In the film, this sound is shown to be the Palmer ceiling fan, and the exact same sound is played in the background when Leland is confronting Laura with truth about her life's tormentor in the train car just before murdering her. This is actually in the pilot, too. The fan is shown in the pilot. And it's what Leland would turn on to mask the sounds, what was going on in the bedroom when he went and had his way with Laura. So that was the point of using the fan. And that's why I think it's zeroed in on to, and it's given this sense of foreboding because, you know, it's eventually going to be revealed to you what it was service or what it was used for.
I think the fan, it has its own special place in the iconography of Twin Peaks and in the mythology of it, because it's a harbinger of sorts. Whenever you see the fan, especially when you see it, not when you see it as a close-up, you know something's going to have to do with Bob, because there's the electricity and, you know, all the reasons you just listed. But when you see it in the long shot, where you usually have Sarah Palmer walking or kind of running down the steps when she can't find Laura that morning, that scene and everything, like when you see it from that vantage point, it probably means right around the same thing. But I think it's cool, because whenever you see it, you know that something bad is about to happen. We're getting to the darker side of this story whenever that's prevalent like that.
This is not an original thought on my part, but I think it's a really, this references some of the things or some of the questions that Daniel has asked us. Do you think that these things like the owls are not what they seem, the electricity, Bob is a way to allow us to discuss or view incest, but distance ourselves from it? Because if it was just incest, where there wasn't all this supernatural stuff, it wouldn't be as, I don't want to say palatable, but we wouldn't engage with it as much and maybe we'd turn away from it. Is that the only way we can actually look at it?
That's really insightful. I had never thought of it that way. Like, so you're saying that Bob and his whole shenanigans are a metaphor for incest,
Right, and I
whereas there's other things in the series that could be seen as a metaphor for drug use, aside from when the characters are actually just straight up using drugs.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I could totally go with that. I could totally see that, because I mean, incest is a really horrible and ugly thing, you know, to see up close like that. And you do need kind of like that hand across the eyes, to where you can kind of peek through your fingers to analyze and to really look at certain things, because otherwise, if you're just viewing them with the naked eye, sometimes it's too much and you flinch away and you're not going to be there for the story that's being told. But having said that, I do think that the story that is being told is realistic. I don't think that Leland Palmer as a person would engage in that. I
No,
don't think that's his intent, you know, and I don't think you do either. It's just, but
I
it
am
is.
on the firm side that he was possessed, and that's how I prefer to
Right.
understand this show.
But as is, but you know, good storytelling is always multifaceted, it's always layered and nuanced, and there's, you know, more than meets the eye, like Transformers, you know. So I think that's really good insight into that. I hadn't really thought about that, but I wholeheartedly agree.
Okay, that's it from Daniel. And thank you, Daniel. Please keep writing because your letters are awesome. You should do
Yeah,
your,
keep them
you
coming.
should do a podcast, actually. You've got good insight. So this is from Tyler, and he says, "Hey guys," he says some nice things, and then I'm going to get on to how he was watching Secrets from Another Place on the making of Twin Peaks today and learned something interesting. Mark Frost says during his interview that he and Lynch planned it to be Leland throughout the first season, but like a Boy Scout pact, decided it was best not to tell anyone. I'd always thought about it, and it seemed Leland fit the bill too perfectly for him being the murderer to be tacked on, though I guess this could be a little backpedaling on Frost's part. Thoughts?
We actually, thank you, Tyler, for the letter and the nice words. It's very much appreciated, and we're glad you're listening.
Yes, thanks, Tyler.
But as to your point, M showed me the parts of the documentary that dealt with that. I haven't watched the whole thing. I think I just watched what, probably the last 45 minutes,
Right.
starting at that point. And yet, it doesn't really change. It's an interesting fact to be put out there, and it gives a lot more context of what's going on, and it feels right, because it always feels like Leland would have been the killer. It just feels too perfect for them to have not known. I agree with that. You know what I mean? When you look at the way the story unfolds, to have it potentially be Dr. Jacoby or Ben Horn or something like that would just feel really, really weird. It wouldn't feel right. So it makes sense that they were just trying to guard their secret. So what I'm left with now is the impression that Frost and Lynch always knew that it would be Leland. They were always going to make it so, but they didn't want anybody else to know that is what it boils down to. So even though they knew the whole time, they kept it from everybody. And you know, you have the part in the documentary where it's talking about how, you know, Ray Wise went in and they told him, and he was just like, oh man, you know, this is the best thing I've ever been part of. I don't want to do this, because, you know, he's a smart guy. He put two and two together and he figured out, well, if I'm the killer, I'm going to be off the show one way or another, because I'm either going to get offed or I'm going to go to jail. So you know, he wasn't really happy about that, but they kept it even a secret from him up until that point.
I did watch the whole documentary, and it is about 1 hour and 45 minutes long. I recommend that you guys listen to the or watch the whole thing, because it's actually a really well put together documentary that it's very cleverly put together, the way they'll use scenes from Twin Peaks to kind of emphasize certain points that they're making with the interviews and things like that, and some of the things that they go over casting and we learned, you know, how Ray Wise thought originally he would play Harry Truman, which is funny to think about. And location, how they came upon the location, which it was serendipitous, and you can learn about that, and how they dealt with weather, and how the weather in some ways heightened certain scenes, such as a scene between Donna and James, and interesting things like Leslie, interviews with like Leslie Lincoln Glatter caught my attention a lot, especially how she's the one who started the whole hotel convention happening in the background. And we saw that in the opening scene of this episode with the,
there was like a barbershop quartet singing in the background.
Right.
Yeah. We forgot to mention that, but I guess you knew you were going to mention it at this point, so we didn't forget anything.
Right. And you learn a lot about the music, which is a really great segment, and even some, you know, drama behind the scenes there with Julie Cruz. And it's actually about 1 hour and 17 minutes in that you learn about Mark Frost, you know, saying how he and David Lynch always knew that it was Leland. And it goes by so fast. It's a great, great documentary to watch. Highly recommend it. And thank you, Tyler, for sending us that link. You can find it if you go into YouTube and you type in Creating Twin Peaks. It's a documentary that was produced by or made by CBS. So check that out. And then so next we have Greg R.
On the lighter side.
Yeah, this is more on the lighter side, this email. So, hello, Stephen M. I'm glad I found the two of you, and it couldn't have happened at a more perfect time. I'm currently taking my wife through the series for her first time. Had I known she hadn't prior, we might not be married. You could imagine how gobsmacked I was when I was in the midst of being overjoyed about the reboot, and she said, "Nah, I've never watched it." We've gotten to about the midway point of the second season, and she hasn't tried to abandon ship yet, so it seems our marriage is safe. I'm glad to have your podcast to help me guide her through the show. My most thorough viewing of it was when it was originally aired. You helped remind me of all the many different plot threads and cryptic goodies hidden throughout this series. 1,000 thanks and keep up the good work. I look forward to... So he's going to check out our Penny Dreadful podcast, which is awesome.
Cool.
And he's going to be sending some feedback in the near future. And don't worry about it being long-winded. You're in good company.
Yeah. We're used to it. Thank you, Greg. That was a very nice letter. And I would say that you're probably safe, because if your wife has made it to the middle of season two and hasn't tried to abandon ship yet, then she's going to be there for the duration.
Yeah, I think so.
If you can get to that point, and you know what we're talking about. So it's funny, though. Your letter is kind of funny, because Em and I probably wouldn't be married right now if it wasn't for the fact that I was okay with Twin Peaks. That was one of the, or just David Lynch in general, because I think I had only seen two David Lynch movies before we got together, that being David Lynch's Dune, which I'm a huge fan of. I know that garners a lot of criticism, but I'm a big fan of the books, and my dad got me into that movie back in the 80s, I think probably just a couple of years after it came out, and I've always loved it. I saw Lost Highway as well, and I think a few years before we got together, but then once we did meet each other, you introduced me to Blue Velvet and Wild at Heart and Twin Peaks. And I took to Twin Peaks like a duck takes to water, so it worked out. And I imagine that I can probably safely speculate that our relationship could have taken a different path, and if I was like, this is crap, what are we watching, you know. But I went into it the opposite way, because I think you had shown me was it the pilot or the first episode first?
Yes, and I'm ashamed of this, because we're from a small town, and all we had at our local video store was the pilot of Twin Peaks and Twin Peaks Fire Walk with Me. And Shamefully, I did this to a lot of people because I was so desperately wanting people to watch it that and this is back in the day when it's still VHS and everything, and
Right.
so that's how I got people watching it, and that was
Yeah.
my only option because I didn't own them, and
Well, this, the internet
so
existed at this point in time, but it was way, way, way different than it was. If you guys remember,
it was nascent. It was still,
yeah,
I
I mean,
mean.
you go to websites and they're still in, these versions, which would be considered like a beta version of something these days. You know what I mean? It was just not like what you're putting out there for public consumption. There was the idea of just going to a website and downloading whatever you wanted to see on the internet was just not there yet. Unless you were just really, really, really well versed in it. And I didn't know anybody who was. I mean, I think I knew one or two people who had a computer that could get on the internet at that time. And I would just go to like record sites and look at all the records you could buy and stuff like that. That's like the only thing that I use it for. And so, yeah, we were stuck in our crappy little town. You could rent the VHS tapes, and that was it. So you could get the first episode, or was it the
The
pilot? The
pilot.
pilot episode, and then you could watch Fire Walk With Me.
That was
So
it.
that was my exposure to Twin Peaks, but I still liked it. And then when I finally got to see it pilot all the way through
We
proper
moved to a
series,
big city,
yeah.
and actually the first week we were there, we walked down into the, it was freezing cold, and we walked to a video store, and we were able to rent the first two episodes. You can only rent two at a
It
time.
was no, what it was they had the VHS tapes of the first season, and but there was two episodes per tape, I
Right.
think.
And you can only rent two at a time.
That might, yeah, I
Because
think
we had to
so.
keep walking back.
That's right, yeah, because it was like an all day thing,
All
because
night. It was nighttime.
it was nighttime, because we would watch the first two and then put in the second tape, and then we'd be like, damn it, and so we'd go back and then get the next ones, and then we finally got up to, the end of season one, which it went by pretty fast because there's only so many episodes in that season. And it was like, damn. And then it wasn't until probably
That store in the mall, we bought the,
it was yeah, there was a
what was that
video store on
called?
the Suncoast.
Suncoast.
Yeah, there's a in the Northwest there's a video chain called Suncoast, and it's not a rental place. It's kind of like a smaller version of Best Buy. They don't sell equipment, they just sell the movies. And at the time when it came out, we heard about it. I don't know if we read it on the internet or something, but we heard about the VHS box set. And I don't know if you guys remember this or if anybody owns it. Write in and tell us about your experiences with the VHS box set. But this was unremastered. It looked like maybe a step above somebody recording it off of network television when it came out. And the only thing you didn't have was the pauses for the commercials where they would have been.
It seemed like it had more of a sepia tone to it, like a more amber color over it than,
Yeah.
which I know they used an amber colored lens or a coral colored lens, and so that I know that costume designers would have to look at the clothing through a coral color lens to make sure that it was gonna, read like they wanted it to. But it just in my memory, it has that more of a cast, and I think that the VHS had that quality to it.
Yeah, I remember it being something because there's scenes where, I mean, you're sitting 3 feet away from the TV or 4 or 5 feet away from the TV and you're like squinting to try to see, and we're both wearing prescription glasses, so it's not an issue of our eyesight. It's just really bad transfer or just really shoddy transfer. They just didn't care. It was just the first time that this was made available for mass consumption like that. And but it was so nice to have it because then you could watch all the season two and everything. No extras, no interviews, no nothing. Just when you get to the end of it, stop and rewind. Old school. But yeah, I really, really liked it. So I understand it's an integral part of a relationship when you've got something like that. I think there's very few things that I would be serious about, if you didn't like, then be like, oh, this is a deal breaker. Maybe like, I don't know, Star Wars or something.
King
But
Diamond.
anyway, Greg, thanks for the letter. We hope you keep listening and we hope your wife keeps watching.
Yes, and thanks, Greg. Yes, thank you very much. And tell your wife we said hi. All right, so that's it. That's it for our feedback. Anything else you want to say before we sign off?
You stole the corn.
I canned it above the convenience store. Yeah, we watched the movie last night. I don't know if we're gonna do a podcast on the movie, so we don't really need to get into it, but it was we hadn't watched it in like I think you said already, long time, 12
At
years.
least 10 years, maybe 12 years, we hadn't
Yeah.
seen it.
And it was a really fun experience.
It was the best time I've had at the movies, watching a movie. in a while. I mean, you know, I went and saw The Hobbit recently, and that was awesome. But this was just something that I was like so totally into. It's kind of like if you've ever had a record in your collection that you haven't listened to in a long time, and then you just pull it off the shelf randomly one day on your way to work, and you play it, and you're like, God damn, this is good. And you just enjoy it that much more for not, you know, having it played all the time. And it was just really fun.
Yeah, and then we watched Missing Pieces after, and it was revealing and at the same time more confusing. All right, so that's it. I am your host, Em.
Now I'm your host, Steve.
We mean it like it is.
Like it sounds. You stole the corn!
This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.